Is it being published yet in India, or is it still hung up on the court?
It's hung up, but it's published. It's called The Lives of Sri Aurobindo by Peter Hees, and it's published by Columbia University Press. I haven't given those references anywhere, so this document is black market. I didn't think about printing the title page when I got it copied, and then the copier was closed today. I'm sorry?
This book which you're talking about, is it on the index of the ashram?
The index?
Yes.
Perhaps. There is some controversy about it, but I'm absolutely not interested in that.
No, I've heard that the trustees of the ashram...
That's right. So let's don't go into that subject.
No, we shouldn't go into that. I understand. But there is no proof. In fact, if anything, they've proved
it. Don.
Yeah.
Thank you. The other respect in which I think it's an interesting book is that it's not only about the life of Sri Aurobindo, but it is very much about the supramental manifestation and the yoga of supramental manifestation. So when you read the book, that becomes dominant. And the little incidental things that people have a problem with disappear. So there may be some, in the conventional understanding of the freedom of speech, all writers say things the way they say things for whatever reason they say them, and that's perfectly legitimate. But the fact that this person has written with the access that he has enabled him to give the kind of information that is most interesting and essential for anybody interested in Sri Aurobindo. And so the idea that Sri Aurobindo was doing something special, and how he developed himself with respect to that special goal is extremely clear in this book. So that's not something that detractors would want to point out because they're interested in detracting. But actually there is a wealth of information that's quite valuable. So we stopped, the time before last, we asked the question, has mind evolved? And what is consciousness? Because in our discussion about has mind evolved, there was a tendency to use the word consciousness in some kind of comprehensive, unspecified manner, so that it was suggested that we might want to look at what we mean by this word. Do we mean mental consciousness, or vital consciousness, or supramental consciousness, or the supreme, unqualified emptiness, or do we mean prakriti, the forces of nature? What exactly do we mean by this term? Does anybody here know what we mean by this term? Or what they mean by this term when they use it so liberally?
Awareness.
Good. Okay, I would say that awareness is the most conventional understanding of the meaning of the word. Force is usually associated with will, volition, in the human being. And in nature, the word for force is usually energy. But awareness is very commonly associated with the word consciousness. And in any current study of mind, and there are many of them currently, because all the physicists and biologists, and not just the philosophers, are asking themselves about consciousness these days. So there are plenty of recent publications, and in most of them, consciousness is defined as awareness. So that was something that we had suggested we might want to pursue, because obviously last time we were speaking about, actually it wasn't us, it was Conrad Lorenz, who was speaking about the behavior of animals, including human beings, as being characterized by learning. And so spontaneous living behavior was characterized by him as essentially a process of cognition. All living things have sensory apparatuses which enables them to get information about their environment and to decide what they're going to do. There is a processing of information that goes on in the nervous system, and then the organism decides whether to eat or not eat, whether to stay and explore or run away. And this is more and more accepted by Darwinian evolutionists as the way nature selects her preferred modes of development. When she has selected a pattern of behavior that is successful, then that tends to be reproduced in other generations. And if the pattern of behavior is not one that she prefers, then she finds another one. Or she dies, she becomes extinct. So this relationship between the organism and the environment, it has been identified nowadays by biologists as a process of consciousness. But this doesn't mean awareness. It means information processing and response, stimulus and response. But not in the pure behaviorist sense of stimulus and response, because the organism has already evolved a network of behaviors that are it, itself, what characterizes it as what it is what responds. And so it responds for a purpose. It responds with self-interest. It responds characteristically with respect to its type. So it's not just learning randomly from whatever stimulus is reinforcing its behavior. It's learning contextually. And it is altering its behavior accordingly. So we have at various times in this course identified two principles that seem to characterize living organisms. One is that they share with all other living organisms certain structural similarities which amount to identities in many cases. For example, sight is a perceptual apparatus that is shared by all living things to some extent. Touch is an apparatus for sensing temperature change and tasting things, and it is shared by all living organisms to some extent. Hearing, there are organs for hearing at just about every level of evolution. So we have identified organs of consciousness, perception. Often consciousness is associated with perception. Which is almost the same as awareness. When the light stimulus reaches your nervous system, you distinguish between this new light and these old lights that we're familiar with spontaneously. You don't have to work very hard to do that. And neither do animals. And so Lorenz identified this as a constancy phenomenon. So there's not only a perception of this new light, but there is an abstraction of its nature in relation to all the other lights in the room. And one immediately realizes that there is a new light structure in this environment. Before you even look at the black frame and ask yourself the question, why is it here or where did it come from, you already know something about it, which you don't reflect upon. And so the nervous system of all living things is storing information all the time, constantly, about itself and its environment.
This is the outer awareness. When you speak about the outer awareness, it goes out towards the ultimate manifestation. How does that relate to the inner awareness?
No idea.
How does
that relate to the body? But What most psychologists would start with in order to answer that question is by asking, what is it that we are aware of? And so you can be aware of something outside, or you can be aware of something inside. And when you look at Sankhya philosophy, you learn from these early psychologists that whether it's inside or outside, it's an object of awareness. And the entity which is aware is something else. And so in modern Western philosophy, this distinction has been made very rigorously between the mind and what it's aware of, the extended world and that which knows the extended world. And so that's one of the features of the human mind which we have identified in our course that is apparently different from the minds of other organisms. The human mind is aware of being aware of things. It reflects upon whether this thing is itself or something else. It takes into consideration some of these constancy phenomena and holds them up before its reflecting mental view, awareness, consciousness. It makes the perceptions objects. And then it takes these objects for the reality. And so then we come to our thinking along the lines that Henri Bergson suggested, and we begin to distinguish between the frame of reference, which we call our mind, which holds before itself all of these static representations of things, and the ground from which they are taken, which is the ground of perception and energy and extension and experience. And many of the things that we know are held in a semi-conscious or unconscious state of the mental apparatus. And so there is a physical mind, there is a vital mind, there's an intellectual mind, there is an intuitive mind, and so on. And Sri Aurobindo says that these planes are all a function of the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti. So the way consciousness relates to the physical, and the way it relates to the vital, and the way it relates to the mental and the intuitive constitute planes. Planes of consciousness, planes of perception, and, lo and behold, planes of reality. Because what Sri Aurobindo does is he objectifies totally the subjective and says, mind is a plane of reality. It is not something that happens between your ears. That is the mental functioning of the human being. But mind itself is something else. The vital is not just your processes of preference and digestion and greed. It is the whole movement of nature to possess, enjoy, and reproduce itself. And the physical is not just atoms and chemicals and cells. The physical is one continuous plane of existence. And so we exist in this physical, and we exist in this vital, and we exist in this mental, and they are the integrated threefold complex known as the manifestation, the world, the threefold world. So behind a little bit and up a little bit in our awareness, if we can put ourselves on the rack and notch it up a little bit, if we can subtilize it a little bit, if we can sort of learn to see the whole and feel deeply what it means, then we find that there are other planes interwoven here in this reality that we occupy. And we can tune in to something outside of us and experience our oneness with it. And so this is called intuition. Hello, doggy. So we've spoken a few times about being able to identify with the emotions of animals. We can sense them. They are real. But when we say we can sense the emotion of animals, we are abstracting from that reality. So now we know everything. We know all about matter and all about life and all about mind and where it's all connected, what it's related to, how much energy it has in it, and what its potentials are. And this Heidegger identifies with, identifies as the frame. And it is the reserve of information and experience and knowledge and that is held by the mind and held by our information retrieval systems and held in reserve for our will to unlock according to our vital or mental or physical urges at any particular moment. And so we can either run out there and club that dog into submission, or we can cultivate its understanding of what we're doing, and it can come and sit quietly in the room and listen to us and enjoy it. Or we can just let someone else take care of it. And we know all of these things are potentials of this situation. So this is one of the things that distinguishes us from other animals, that we reflect upon the frame of objectivity. We can also care deeply about the frame of objectivity and put it away from us and act in a way that is respectful and sympathetic and nurturing. Most animals do this only with their kin or with at least their own species. But we have this ethical mind, which is, it's the rational mind plus care, which seems to me to characterize human mind more than anything else. Because every human society, as far back as we know, has put in place rules for the individual to control his behavior for the sake of commonly recognized benefits. So human society is characterized by ethical behavior to an extent that is far beyond any other species' behavior. And then Conrad Lorenz tells us that we ritualize this, whereas most species ritualize behavior to communicate about their own survival patterns. We ritualize everything just for the sake of communicating, because we don't depend upon objects being present in order to determine our response. The objects exist for us always. And so religions ritualize our deepest feelings and inspirations and rules of conduct so that we don't commit adultery and kill our neighbors and steal what we want just because it'll be good for us. We put in abeyance these drives, and even to the point of not procreating and not eating for the sake of liberation from the demands of the environment, inner and outer. So we are looking at a process of the emergence in the human being of a vast range of behaviors that we relate to the term consciousness. The more conscious we are, the more capable we become of putting on hold our animal drives for the sake of our values. And we ritualize this behavior in a vast range of ways, from music and theater to religion and courtrooms and universities to sports fields and sports bars and just about everything we do is some ritualized form of more natural animal behavior. So Sri Aurobindo considers some of these things in a similar way to this. I'm going to refer to the chapter called Man and the Evolution, which I think for this course is the most pertinent one. I hope they haven't changed the page numbers in this new edition. Next it... They have changed the page numbers in the new edition. I didn't think that they were... Man and the Evolution, yeah. Okay, let me see if I can find that page and then I can coordinate it. So it's... Well, why don't I just read it to you?
No, you should find it.
It's too difficult. Here?
Yeah, you're typing there. It's a science here now. Yeah,
present. Okay, I typed in, now what I do. This one? Okay. So the new edition is different from the other most recent edition. Who said that? Would you like to move a little closer? I think there'll be some room by Kirti, there's some room. Yeah, it's still page 841. That's good. But that's not the same. It may be conceded that. Okay, let's do this one. It may be conceded that what man has up till now principally done is to act within the circle of his nature on a spiral of nature movement, sometimes descending, sometimes ascending. There has been no straight line of progress, no indisputable, fundamental, or radical exceeding of his past nature. What he has done is to sharpen, subtilize, make a more and more complex and plastic use of his capacities. It cannot truly be said that there has been no such thing as human progress, since man's appearance, or even in his recent ascertainable history. For however great the ancients, however supreme some of their achievements and creations, however impressive their powers of spirituality, of intellect, or of character, there has been in later developments an increasing subtlety, complexity, manifold development of knowledge and possibility in man's achievements. Politics, society, life, science, metaphysics, knowledge of all kinds. This progress has not indeed carried the race beyond itself into a self-exceeding, a transformation of the mental being. But that was not to be expected. For the action of evolutionary nature in a type of being and consciousness is first to develop the type to its utmost capacity by just such a subtilization and increasing complexity, till it is ready for her bursting of the shell, the ripened, decisive emergence, reversal, turning over of consciousness on itself, that constitutes a new stage in the evolution. If it is to be, if it be supposed that her next step is the spiritual and supramental being, the stress of spirituality in the race may be taken as a sign that that is nature's intention. The sign, too, of the capacity of man to operate in himself or aid her to operate the transition. If the appearance in animal being of a type similar in some respects to the ape kind, but already from the beginning endowed with the elements of humanity, was the method of human evolution, the appearance in the human being of a spiritual type resembling mental animal humanity, but already with the stamp of the spiritual aspiration on it, would be the obvious method of nature for the evolutionary production of the spiritual and supramental being. One of the questions that we also asked was, is there any indication not only that mind has evolved, but that it may still be evolving beyond its present limits? And the argument that Sri Aurobindo makes throughout the book, continually, is that the presence in the human mind of rationality itself indicates the will to transcend. Because human rationality conceives of the ideal in society, It makes these rules governing human behavior because it can imagine a perfectly regulated world. It can imagine making its members better, higher, more evolved through education and training and imparting values. But they are not there now in the form that they are envisioned to become. And so the essence of rationality is that we abstract from the immediate world of constancy phenomena and project a totality which is different from what we perceive. And we, from the very beginning of this course, we entertained some of the ideas of Aristotle, who said that the form of the thing is its fully realized potential. At nowhere along its line of development do we see that, until it becomes fully realized. And so his idea was that the development of any living thing towards the realization of its full potential is determined by its form, which is its essence. But where does that exist? That doesn't even exist in the current space-time dimension, because we are all transitory, temporal entities right now in the process of dying. And none of us right now is in the process of creating beautiful art. But we know that that is our true nature, to be immortal and to express immortality through poetry and art and noble actions. And so even right now we are not fully realized. But this human mind has this capacity to do that thing which one of our members sometimes so heavily criticizes, project. Now, we can project our ideals on things for the purpose of judging them and condemning them, and that's what she doesn't like. But you know what I'm referring to, I think. The Scottish lady who often comes here often comments about the tendency of the human mind to project and make value judgments about things which aren't true. And that, of course, is true. But it does other things besides that. And it uses this idealizing mind to transcend its limitations. And also to know things with respect to their truth. So, in Western philosophy and in Eastern philosophy both, there comes from a very early time the idea that what we perceive is not the truth of things, but that the truth of things is, with respect to the human being, for example, the self, the supreme self, the immortal self. The form, Plato's form, otherwise known as the good, translated by Sri Aurobindo as the supreme truth. The good, with a capital G, it means that divine, luminous potential that attracts everything to become what it really is. And then in biology we learn that nothing ever becomes what it really is, it just keeps changing. And so the Platonic, suddenly with evolution, the idea of the Platonic ideal evolves. And it's no longer the particular possibility of the human or of the state or of the sculpture, or of the laboring species, it is goodness itself in these things which evolves. In our language, we could say it is consciousness in these things which evolves. And so Sri Aurobindo in this section refers to the type of whatever the species is, you know, the type is a structure through which certain qualities evolve over many generations. So and then he refers to the human being's ability to cultivate species for particular purposes. And nature does the same thing, but more slowly. And so the evolution of primates, for example, from that first little shrew which decided it preferred living in the tree, to the first tarsiers and lower primates, to the most evolved primates, to the first anthropoid species. This is the process of evolving what we're talking about here, the mind. The mind is evolving in these types, in these vital physical structures. The mind is what is evolving. And the mind is capable of evolving beyond all of these structures and behaviors that we are so familiar with on Earth today, because it isn't finished. And it needs some new structures, in fact, and some new behaviors. But it is already able to have a sense of what those are. And this is Sri Aurobindo's main importance. Through intuition, and you know, it was Bergson who decided that this has to evolve now because the mental frame isn't serving us very well anymore. But Sri Aurobindo developed a path for evolving the intuition, a methodology, a practice, an intention, and in himself attempted to manifest fully what that intuitive mind could do, what its behavior would be like. So, mind, according to his philosophy, is a product of evolution in general, and it has achieved in the human species a fairly high level of manifestation of its potentials, and it has recognized the ability to evolve beyond itself. And so it has taken over the responsibility for evolution. Evolution has evolved. And it's no longer happening on the ground of nature through immediate perception and response. It's now happening on a level of rational, ideal will. So I will, for the sake of time, saving time, let me just remind you that we have mentioned often that we share the structures of mind, life, and matter with all other living things, so there is a principle of unity. And we have recognized often that each individual in each species acts from its own center according to its own type to achieve its own ends. And so there is, from the most basic structure of life, a self. that is developing, that is determining the choices that are made by it. And its self choices tend to be made in context with its environment and the choices that other individuals are making. And evolution has happened like this. And so if we look at biology, it tells us that there's a principle of innate structure in things. And language is an innate structure in the human being. And hearing and sight are innate structures in all species. And we have this amazing awareness suddenly that the organs of consciousness have been evolving from the beginning. And so clearly, if its organs have been evolving from the beginning, then consciousness must have been evolving from the beginning. These structures. This is Sri Aurobindo's fundamental philosophy of nature. There is no difference between nature and consciousness. Then we look at the Upanishads and we see that the perception of universal self determining each thing's individuality as will has been there from the beginning of human awakening. The ability to respect others and to know others and to identify with others is based upon the self in each individual, which is totally unique and at the same time absolutely one with every other individual. Consciousness is not always aware of that because it is stuck in the egoistic mental level of separating the outer and the inner and me and you and how I feel today from larger perceptions and principles. But it has the capacity to transcend conventional perceptions and behaviors and to identify with each and every entity. And this is intuition. This is the intuitive mind, which is emerging. But it requires the will to set it forth as a goal and to suppress the ordinary mental behaviors, which fragment and abstract and reduce things to objects. So Sri Aurobindo, in the process of analyzing evolution, applied the principles of spiritual knowledge to the process of evolution itself and how to achieve the evolution of a higher consciousness. And then he speaks about reversals, which maybe we'll look at next time. One of the principles that he observes is that with the emergence of each new type of consciousness, there is a reversal that takes place, and that consciousness realizes itself through all of the pre-existing structures. So life, when it emerged, utilized matter to realize all of its potentials. Mind, when it emerged, utilized all the structures of life and matter to realize its potentials. Now, when this intuitive or higher mind or supermind emerges, there's a reversal and it starts to change the way mind ordinarily works. It starts to change the way the vital ordinarily works. There's a reversal by which it integrates itself into the threefold complex. So Sri Aurobindo adds this idea of reversal in the emergence and integration of new principles. we still have not, in our philosophy of evolution, had any need to ask a metaphysical question. We have not yet entered into the realm of metaphysics. Let me point that out. We have not yet asked why. Because so far it has been possible to develop a philosophy of evolution that is totally involved in nature. All we have to do is recognize, as science does today, that consciousness and matter are corollaries. One does not exist without the other. And Sri Aurobindo begins The Life Divine with this argument. He asks the question, what is consciousness? And he says, well, first of all, what we perceive is energy. So the universe is energy. But it's energy doing things. It's not just random energy. It's energy organizing itself in patterns and producing species, producing life. Matter itself can't produce life. Matter is matter, but life gets produced. And life itself can't produce consciousness. Consciousness gets produced. And so he comes up with a conclusion that I was going to refer back to John Locke, 1690, in which the same argument is offered, and it is the argument that Sri Aurobindo repeats almost verbatim. Mind cannot be produced by matter. Nothing can emerge from matter or from life which was not already there. So this has been a perception since the very awakening of the rational mind in the period of the Enlightenment. It was already there in the Upanishads as well. So at the end of The Life Divine, there is a kind of a summary of these ideas in the last chapter, page 1016. It is consciousness. I want the paragraph which starts, it is consciousness and life that must be the key words. Is it on the screen?
No, but you can see it in Margaret's book.
On to page what?
1016.
Well, that's what page I'm on. Must be 1017.
No, now you have 1017, but 1016 isn't.
Yeah, but it wasn't on that page. Where is this in your book, before or after? No, this line here. It should be on page 2 of the chapter.
Well, yeah, it is on the second page of the chapter. So why don't you type in those the words again, and you'll get it up there in that little box.
Okay. Did I miss the I? No, there it is.
There.
No. What page is it here?
1060.
No, on this one?
1052.
Boy, how did they manage that, I wonder? It is consciousness and life that must be the key words to what is being worked out in time. For without them, matter and the world of matter would be a meaningless phenomenon, a thing that has just happened by chance or by an unconscious necessity. But consciousness as it is, life as it is, cannot be the whole secret, for both are very clearly something unfinished and still in process. So we have this idea that being still in process means being unfinished. Consciousness and life are there in matter, but they are not perfect. They are not what we would like them to be. Now, the scientist would say, that's philosophical thinking. They are just what they are. And you can observe them, and if you don't like them, too bad. This is it. But the philosopher says, but we need to try to improve them.
But the scientists say it is only the moment, and we look now in the change. It is observing.
Yeah, we're looking at the change. But as we have pointed out 100 times here, when we look at the change, we see patterns. And we stop with the pattern. And then we compare it to another pattern. And this is what we call knowledge. And then we try to apply that knowledge for our own purposes of survival and improvement and beauty and joy. And we find out that it doesn't give us quite what we would like many times. And even when it does give us what we like, it disappears fairly soon in the onrush of time. So we have this sense of being on the way. Sri Aurobindo has formulated that here. In us, consciousness is mind. And our mind is ignorant and imperfect. An intermediate power that has grown and is still growing towards something beyond itself. And Bergson has explained that very well, you know, why it's limited, how it's limited, and why it needs to go beyond itself.
At this point, I can say I'm so happy that this computer everywhere. Before it was the people pretend they know everything, but more and more in the last 10 years, every person comes to the point that he doesn't know it. And so I think this is a big help in the shift of this consciousness. What was before, the people had been educated, he had been the things who knows, and the other had been the unknown, and there was always a gap in between.
Now we know everything, and it's still not enough. And consciousness now, from in the future, from now on, consciousness is not about knowing things, as Bergson told us. It's about being. And when we achieve that consciousness of being, we don't need to make rocket ships and ocean liners and faster motorcycles. We just need to be, because things in themselves are beautiful and divine and so on. So that's a direction in which some minds have an intuition that we should go. Not all of them, by any means. Many of them don't think that. But there are some minds that do think that. There were lower levels of consciousness that came before it, the human mind, and out of which it arose. There must very evidently be higher levels to which it is itself arising. And the main proof of that is spiritual experience. Before our thinking, reasoning, reflecting mind, there was a consciousness unthinking, but living and sentient. Sentient means conscious. There was a consciousness unthinking, which means sentient, able to be cognizant. After us, or in our yet unevolved selves, there is likely to be waiting a greater consciousness, self-luminous, not dependent on constructive thought. So here, this concept of the self, which was there from the beginning, which each type of creature develops to its maximum capacity, becomes a self which is in itself everything. It has no need for objects. It is self-knowing, self-acting, self-luminous, self-fulfilled self, period. One with everything, yet unique and adequate. Self-sufficient. Our imperfect and ignorant thought mind is certainly not the last word of consciousness, its ultimate possibility. For the essence of consciousness is the power to be aware of itself and its objects. And in its true nature, this power must be direct, self-fulfilled, and complete. If it is in us indirect, incomplete, unfulfilled in its workings, dependent on constructed instruments, it is because consciousness here is emerging from an original veiling in conscience, and is yet burdened and enveloped with the first nescience proper to the inconscient. But it must have the power to emerge completely. Its destiny must be to evolve into its own perfection, which is its true nature. Its true nature is to be wholly aware of its objects, and of these objects, the first is self. The being which is evolving its consciousness here, and the rest is what we see as not self. But if existence is indivisible, one, that too must in reality be self. The destiny of evolving consciousness must be, then, to become perfect in its awareness, entirely aware of self and all aware. The practice of yoga is meant to enable the emergence of an all-aware self-consciousness. Now, if we had that consciousness, we would act in unison for the best of everything. The will would be directly influenced by that truth consciousness of all selves. And this would change the nature of relationships. So then existence, human existence would be super ethical, because each one would be oneself. And it has been an intuition like that which has driven higher thinking in the human mind for thousands of years. But it has been handicapped and retarded by the hold of other energies, rational and vital and physical, other patterns of behavior that needed to evolve in order to make a structure capable of this. Then we enter into a time consciousness. It is this which is time, which is duration, in all of its multifaceted moments. So Bergson said, we enter into a consciousness of duration. Time consciousness as being one with the movement of energy in things. Not time as an abstraction which separates moments. That was Bergson's thought. Moments would cease to exist, he said. Because the self-being would be all time. It would be all potential and all realization of potential and all lack of realization of potential. So it would be ever-changing, it would not be static. It would be the timeless and time combined. And Bergson slapped the name intuition on that, a nice label. But Sri Aurobindo has given a whole psychological and metaphysical description of its levels and processes, experiences, as an indication of the next step in evolution as he envisions it. Okay, thanks for the attention.
Thank you.